least on the surface with hedonism, you would think that that could be an option, right? Like, oh, well, if I'm just all about pleasure. Again, Nagel's point, quite obviously, is this doesn't make any sense. Like, nobody wants to do this. And in fact, there's that little kind of tidbit at the end where it's like, and in fact, it doesn't a life where you, wasn't an interesting but perhaps more difficult life where you're a writer and you're intelligent and you make close friendships for good and for ill. Doesn't that sound like like if you had to pick between the two lives, who's going to pick basically becoming like a little human pig or like baby man?
Yeah, a little baby man.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
Right? Like, now, I put on my note beside this, I wrote other values besides, you know, besides pleasure. And I wrote one. Now, this is the one that normally comes up, but it's just the one that I thought of, which is, I describe it as depth, the value of depth, which basically means, to me, writing it out, that clearly this is hinting at good lives have more than just pleasure going on. And in fact, they often have a certain degree of kind of layering and variety and a certain degree of also to, what's what I'm looking for, kind of not unknownness, but inconsistency, adventure, whatever you want to call it, right? Where like, you know, there are ups and downs and there are friends and there are enemies and there are lovers and there are breakups.
You bump up against the wall that is reality in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's your reality, your life is full of different things, right? And you interact with, and your life has some depth, right? You're not walking in the very shallow end with just your feet in. You're fully in life, and there's stuff that happens for good or bad, but it's important that it has that, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that, and I know what I'm doing when I elect this, putting this here, but I think that one of the things that this excludes is experiences. I think this is one of the things that you're kind of alluding to here when you talk about depth, but I'm just bringing it out in terms of, well, this person isn't going to have the kind of variety of experiences that we would think a meaningful life should have. They're not going to engage with different viewpoints, with different kinds of people. They're not going to have disagreements. They're not going to confound themselves. They'll never have the opportunity to surprise themselves by putting themselves out there and seeing what they can really do with themselves. Now, I say that too because one of the things, the other counterexample is going to involve this throwing yourself into experiences, which will complicate things.
Yeah, and I think another way to think about this for our audience, as I try and reconstruct it in my mind, is imagine, let's take away pleasure for a second, and let's replace pleasure with safety, right? And say, let's just say we're in an ethical system where there is nothing more important than being safe, right? Being out of harm's way. That's not really the same thing as being pleasured. It's the avoidance of bad things. Not necessarily the striving towards good. But anyways, imagine that's our central pillar of our ethical system. Well, in a kind of similar vein, what would the safest life look like? Well, maybe you put yourself in a white room, in a box, where you get super bland meals served 3 times a day, and there's nothing that you can hurt you, and everything in the room is soft, and you stay in there forever because it's the safest place in the universe. Now, that might be true. It might be the safest place in the universe. But obviously, just like how the infantile man is clearly missing something in terms of the variety, adventure, the depth of life, so too is the person who's going to be endlessly safe, right? That person is also going to be completely cut off from a meaningful life that is, you know, like makes this whole thing worth doing. Moving on to the next one, I think that's the next example. This one's by Robert Nozick. This is my personal favorite, I actually think. I think there's a lot of interesting... I think we could do a whole episode on this one. But it's called The Deceived Man. So here it is. It goes, suppose we read the biography of a man who felt happy, took pride in his work, family life, etc. But we also read that his children secretly despised him, his wife secretly scorned him, having innumerable affairs. His work was subject of ridicule of all others who kept their opinions from him. Every source of satisfaction in this man's life was built upon a falsehood, a deception. Do you, in reading about this man's life, think, what a wonderful life. I wish I or my children could lead it. And don't say that you wouldn't want to lead the life because all the deceptions and falsehoods might come out, making the man unhappy. They didn't. So again, just to reanalyze that, basically, what would we think of a life of a guy who, from his experience, was very pleasurable, right? He had a great, in his experience, he had a great wife, he had great kids, he had a great job, he had lots of friends, he was well-esteemed in his community, everything was getting thumbs up, A pluses in his experience, but in fact, there was some wild conspiracy going on where everyone actually hated him, nobody liked him, and everyone just basically pandered to him while he was around, but he never found out. He never knew that. And so then he lived his life in this very high pleasure rating of it always seeming really good. It always having, this is, you know, a big one, the appearance of being good.
Yeah, and I was going to say, too, the important bit is that it's not just that he doesn't find out, or that is, like, that's the crux of it, right, is it doesn't, you know, at the end on his deathbed or something, it doesn't all come out or something like that. Like, he actually genuinely lives a full life where he believes that he's engaging in these authentic experiences and he's developing these deep relationships with loved ones. And yet, at the bottom, at rock bottom, it's all false, right? I mean, when I think about the kinds of experiences that a person would have to have with someone in order to sort of ascertain that their relationship is trusting or truthful or loving, this person, I mean, ultimately they lack that. They don't know how to tell that the relationships that they have are ones where they know the truth, right? Otherwise they would have found out. I mean, that's not really a part of the thought experiment as it's laid out, but there is something deprived from their life, and it has to be something like an experience of really knowing something. Just like, I think that this is probably one of its like side projects, is that it's trying to challenge us to see, like, do we really know we all engage in like relatively superficial relationships, but there are relationships that we have where we feel like we really connect with someone at rock bottom, you know, you and I are in this together or something like that. And it's meant to kind of shake that up. But I think that this is more that the deceived man just doesn't have any of that, right?
It certainly illustrates, and I actually put beside, when I put the, you know, the these are the values, the one that I put beside this one was authenticity, illustrating that there's a significant lack of, you could also say, honesty, but authenticity of this man's life. And what I mean by that is the way in which this guy experience the world might have been pleasurable, but the way in which the world that he thought he was living in and he's experiencing all this pleasure was not actually the way the world is the key, right? He is missing essential pieces of his own life, and if that's the case, then how could he ever be living authentically? He might not know it, right? But it's certainly not a situation in which any of us would want to step into, right? Like, there's something very, this one in particular, I find has a certain kind of like icky flavor to it of being like, yeah, I definitely don't want to be that guy. Like, could you imagine being the guy that like thinks everybody, you know, he thinks everyone loves him, he thinks he's having such a good life, but everyone actually thinks he's like a total loser behind his back or whatever it might be, right? That sounds really, really unpleasant, but because I am, you know, not afforded pieces of critical information, I don't experience it as unpleasant. I experience it as pleasurable, which is really, you know, not. But again, from the context of it, of the hedonist, well, from his subjective experience, it is good.
Yeah, I mean, for the hedonist, because life kind of is surface value, and what you get is what you get. If this person managed to fake it through the way of their life and get all that pleasure, well, then okay, who cares? Like, if you're rich and everyone, you know, kisses the ring. Okay, well, that's what the good life looks like. I mean, it's not, it might leave a sour taste in your mouth, but, you know, that's life.
The last one, people might be familiar with this. This is probably the most famous one, and it's been used for a bunch of other stuff, but it's called The Experience Machine. It's also by Robert Nozick. So, he goes on to say, suppose there is an experience machine that would give you an experience, would give you, sorry, any experience you desired. Super duper psychologists have stimulated your brain so that you would think and feel that you were writing a great novel or making a friend or reading an interesting book. All the time, you would be floating in a tank with electrodes attached to your brain. Before I go on, I want to say one small aside, which is these examples are always so funny to me because they reveal so much of the writer. Because multiple times in here, there's been discussions about writing or books being the penultimate actual pleasure that people want to have. I just think that it's very, I'm like, this is clearly written by an academic person because he's like, wouldn't you want to experience a real pleasure like reading a book? But the experience machine is an obvious one. I put beside it, I wrote actually the term reality. So which I think is different than authenticity and different than depth. So what I mean by reality is, on some base level, there's a value in, or there's a certain value in people's lives being real, right? If that everything that is happening to you, you can assert on some level, or at least reasonably believe, is actually the case, and that things have this kind of what you might even call metaphysical reliability to them, right? That my world is indeed a world, and the things that happen in that world are actual events and actual states of affairs, and I don't exist in a tank, or I'm not being tricked by an evil demon, or I'm not under some kind of spell, right? This is that notion of reality, right? That I think is really important, except for potentially a hedonist. As long as you are really experiencing pleasure, then it might not matter about what any of the background is. It could be, you could just be in the matrix.
The hedonist is in a, like, the, because obviously these case examples are meant to make the hedonist look like someone who is sort of off the rails in a certain way, like the kind of person who would actually get in the experience machine. We would say, all right, by, and we would be pretty happy to be rid of them. The kind of person is crazy. There's something like psychologically disturbing about not just ourselves entering that, but the kind of person that you would have to be to enter this kind of machine seems sort of incomprehensible. And I think that's one of the things that, because I think, yes, going into the experience machine compromises a sense of reality that we all feel and want to experience. But for me, when I try and think about like what's actually wrong with this, there seems to be a kind of psychological continuity that needs to be broken in order to enter the experience machine. Like, I know that when I get in this, everything prior to this I would have to forget. Right? Because I'm no longer going to be experiencing anything else but these experiences that I've elected to have in the experience machine. There's almost like a kind of psychological or like almost ego death that you have to go through to get into this thing. And you have to leave behind something. And it's, for me, it's more the breaking continuity of myself that is more psychologically disturbing than, because I mean, if I could, you know, if there was a genie that came out of a lamp and I had three wishes, well, there's no problem, right? I could have whatever experience I want because it's sort of wound up with the continuity of my life. But when I step into that experience machine, really, that's it. Like, this self that I am right now kind of dies in a way. And that seems, when I think about it and I really get down to it, because in a certain way, something like the experience machine, again, like genie in a lamp, if we could make wishes, that would be awesome. But something specifically about the experience machine seems disturbing.
Well, I think too, I think you're kind of hinting at something that I wrote. I wrote another little note on the side of my paper here, which is I wrote to myself, well, what is the difference between real pleasure and fake pleasure? Right? Now, you know, the hedonist doesn't really seem to make, at least on our initial reading, there doesn't seem to be make much distinction. I think maybe at the end of here we'll get into a little bit of a possible distinction. But I think that, you know, the simple hedonist, you might call it, makes the mistake of saying, well, there is no difference between real pleasure and fake pleasure. But I think, as you're kind of illustrating, there obviously is, right? Because, you know, would I rather, I guess it's like, would I rather be put into a VR, let's take a classic example of pleasure, like sensuality, sexuality, that kind of things. It's like, would I rather be, you know, experiencing something like that for real with someone that I actually care about and am sexually attracted to and I'm interested in, all this kind of stuff? Or would I rather have that experience in like a machine, like a virtual reality machine and stuff, which I think unfortunately is like more and more of an actual thing. To me, it's the answer seems obvious, but at the end, it's like even pleasure itself, I think, can have this authentic or inauthentic, this real or this unreal kind of character to it. And obviously the unreal variation is sort of like, you might call it like diet pleasure. Or it acts as if it's giving the sensations that are the ones that you would be wanting, but it's only acting as if it's giving those things, not actually performing the type of pleasure, you know, system that, you know, you one is seeking out.
Yeah, I mean, in our ordinary experiences, like when we have some food and it's pleasant, that pleasant food is accompanied, obviously, by the pleasure of having it. Now, we can abstract that pleasure away from it, and then we can imagine all kinds of sci-fi scenarios where we just give the people the pleasure minus the actual thing that in its natural form provides that pleasure. And there, that abstraction gives us a kind of uncanny feeling. First of all, the capacity to do that at all, and the fact that like technologies are evolving that are allowing us to do that, you know, like virtual reality or something like that. It does seem to offend not just like a kind of epistemic thing at all, but almost like a psychological breach of reality. There's like an uncanny feeling to it. And the point that I think you're making is that pleasures accompanied by that uncanniness seem to be unreal in a way that we would genuinely reject them or abstain from entertaining them in order to instead pursue the real thing.
Now, I guess the question is, as we come to our last little section here, you know, obviously we've been pretty hard on hedonists. It's kind of easy in some way, but is there some level of like retort or way of reconstruing hedonism or positive hedonism so that maybe it's a little bit more palatable, it makes a little bit more sense, and it can account for some of these issues, right? There is someone that did this, or at least tried. That was Fred Feldman. And he basically, I'll read out to, for everybody what he came up with, but basically comes up with making a distinction within the system of pleasures, that there's two different types of pleasures. There's sensory pleasures, there's attitudinal pleasures. Let me read what he actually says. So he says, and so far, just to be clear, we've been thinking more in terms of sensory pleasures, but he says this: attitudinal pleasures are different. A person takes attitudinal pleasure in some state of affairs if he enjoys it. Is pleased about it, is glad it is happening, is delighted by it. Attitudinal pleasures are always directed onto objects, just as beliefs and hopes and fears are directed onto objects. This is one respect in which they are different from sensory pleasures. Another difference is that attitudinal pleasures need not have any feeling. We know we have them not by sensation, but in the same way, whatever it may be, that we know that we believe something or hope for it or fear that we might have it. So Feldman makes this distinction of attitudinal pleasures, which I do believe is a pretty significant shift. And I can see the virtues in making this move a little bit. And I think the most important thing, as he says here, a person takes attitudinal pleasure in some state of affairs. So again, this is not the difference between attitudinal pleasures, sensory pleasures, is this is not about
the BC Nurses Union
feeling that some event, activity, entity gives you, right? This is about being, you might say, rather than pleasured, pleased, happy that some state of affairs is the case. So I might be pleased that my marriage is going well. I might be pleased that I have the job that I always wanted. And I also might strive for these things that I find pleasing, because I find them pleasing, and that pleasingness is pleasurable, although it's not pleasurable in the sense of like being a sensory overload. It's more that I'm happy that I can be aware that such and such is the case.
Right. Yeah. You're pleased about an accomplishment that you had or that you were able to achieve, even though, say, you had to, and I think this goes into what we were talking about a little bit earlier, is something like sacrifice went into it, or you had to put a lot of work into it. And that required not only abstaining from pleasures, but even maybe subjecting yourself to pain and stress in order to accomplish it. That attitudinal pleasure, which is propositional, is directed at a belief that you have to form cognitively, it's a different kind of pleasure than a sensory pleasure. One of the other consequences of this as well is that since it is cognitive, it's only open to beings with mental functions or mental functionality. So humans, this is not something that's open to non-human animals, or at least as far as they don't think or can't form cognitions, which I think is another way that Feldman is trying to, because later on he talks about altitude, where he makes a distinction between higher and lower pleasures. I think that Feldman is really, he's keenly aware of John Stuart Mill's distinction between higher and lower pleasures, and he's trying to revise that to make a lot more sense, because like Feldman points out that something like altitude, this distinction between higher and lower is problematic, so he makes a distinction between attitudinal and sensory. But it captures the same thing that John Stuart Mill is talking about, because for John Stuart Mill, the higher pleasures are essentially mental pleasures, but all attitudinal pleasures will also be mental. So it's theoretically conservative, right?
Yeah. Let's say what Feldman actually wrote about this specifically, what you're saying. He said every potential object of intrinsic attitudinal pleasure can be ranked on a scale according to its suitability to serve an object of pleasure. We can say that the scale positions such objects according to their altitude. Mental, moral, and aesthetic objects have high altitude. Physical, bodily have low altitude. Every episode of intrinsic altitude pleasure is good in itself. But we can add that the intrinsic value of such a pleasure is not simply a matter of quantity or pleasure taken. Rather, to find the intrinsic value of an episode of pleasure, we multiply the amount of pleasure in that episode by the altitude of the object of that pleasure. So, like, just like you're saying, and like Mill pointed out, you know, you could have pleasures that are basically of a higher quality, right? You can have pleasures that are more important, that give more value to one's life. Generally, these pleasures aren't sensory oriented the same way that, say, you know, sex or drugs or food or whatever is going to be. And that because, you know, going back again, thinking about this kind of consequentialist system or a utilitarian system, we can do a calculation where, okay, the having a lot of sex versus being really, really engrossed in Plato's Republic are both very pleasurable, but, you know, once one is kind of a more simple pleasure and the other is really made exponential by the fact that it's this kind of deep, highfalutin, high-oriented thing that really expands and gives us more than just sensory feeling.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things about this is that since Looper and Feldman are both analytics, they like to draw on mathematics to try and coordinate their concepts. And I think that it actually kind of works out interestingly well in this case. So, for example, sometimes we have sensory pleasures that are enormously pleasant, but upon reflection, it actually diminishes them. The propositional thought is more, say, shameful or immoral than the act itself. So, in a way, it has like an attitudinal pleasure value of like minus or something like that. So you multiply it into the gross number of the sensory pleasure and you get a negative number by the end of it. So in a certain way, because of our higher mental functioning, or because of our ability to reflect on our sensory ability or on our sensory pleasure, we're kind of forced on reflection to find, oh, that's not so great.
There's more to say about Feldman's system. It's probably not going to save hedonism, but it's certainly a good old college try. But I do think exactly a great example of what you're saying, the kind of end is, you know, so something like severe, like heavy drug use, right, would be an example of something that is, you know, initially on the scale is pleasurably very, very high. Perhaps it's one of the highest things that people can actually do in some cases. It is, has so many other significant negative effects, whether those be to a person's body, mental state, mind, social standing, social interactions, reliability, whatever it's going to be, all this kind of stuff that we find important, then it actually has, like you're saying, a negative altitude. That even though it's sensory, it is a sensory pleasure, it just drags itself down with so much other stuff. And it might, because it actually prevents people from even potentially achieving other altitudinal pleasures, it even sinks even lower, right? Because it's like, yeah, on the first event, this one event, this pleasure at time T, the specific time, is very, very high, but it has an overarching negative state of affairs accompanying with it that just makes it not a, not the kind of thing that would ever realistically have a high position on something like Feldman's scale. Really glad that everybody joined us for this conversation on hedonism. I feel like maybe there's some expansion to be made in the future, but for now, you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and I hope you have a very pleasurable week ahead of you.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Bird Note. Bird voices can vary tremendously. When you're learning to recognize birds by ear, it can help to have shared vocabulary to describe how they sound. For example, some birds have clear singing voices, like this American robin. The scarlet tanager's song holds a similar tune, but this bird sounds a little hoarse. The word nasal comes to mind when describing the call of a red-breasted nuthatch. While the brown-headed nuthatch comes off as squeaky. Other birds are so buzzy that they're easily mistaken for insects, like this grasshopper sparrow. Some birds sound almost mechanical, like the metallic song of the common grackle and the simple clicking notes of a yellow rail. Then there are aficionados like song sparrows that mix and match tones in complex compositions. Learning to describe bird sounds will make it easier to figure out who's singing and to remember the voices of your favorite birds. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rummel.
On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. The women in our communities deserve to feel safe from both emotional and physical abuse. They deserve men who control their anger. Most importantly, they deserve to know the people they love most will never hurt them. Men like me stand up to create a safer world for the women in our lives. And we're looking to men like you, the men who make up our communities, to join us. You can play an active part to end violence. Visit www.whiteribbon.ca.